45. I escape the web datasphere just before escape ceases to be an option. It is incredible and oddly disturbing, the sight of the megasphere swallowing itself. Braun Lamia's view of the megasphere as an organic thing, a semi-sentient organism more analogous to an ecology than a city, was essentially correct. Now, as the Farcaster links cease to be and the world inside those avenues folds and collapses upon itself, the external datasphere simultaneously collapsing, like a burning big-top tent, suddenly without poles, wires, guys, or stakes. The living megasphere devours itself like some ravenous predator gone mad, chewing its own tail, belly, entrails, forepaws, and heart, until only the mindless jaws are left, snapping on emptiness. The metasphere remains, but it is more wilderness than ever now. Black forests of unknown time and space, sounds in the night, lions, and tigers, and bears. When the void which binds convulses and sends its single, banal message to the human universe, it is as if an earthquake has sent ripples through solid rock. Hurrying through the shifting metasphere above Hyperion, I have to smile. It is as if the god analog has grown tired of the ants scribbling graffiti on its big toe. I don't see God, either one of them, in the metasphere. I don't try. I have enough problems of my own. The black vortexes of the web and core entrances are gone now, erased from space and time like warts removed, vanished as thoroughly as whirlpools in water when the storm has passed. I am stuck here, unless I want to brave the metasphere. Which I do not. Not yet. But this is where I want to be. The datasphere is all but gone here in Hyperion system. The pitiful remnants on the world itself, and in what remains of the Force fleet, drying up like tide pools in the sun. But the time tombs glow through the metasphere like beacons in the gathering darkness. If the Farcaster links had been black vortexes, the tombs blaze like white holes shedding an expanding light. I move toward them. So far, as the one who comes before, all I have accomplished is to appear in others' dreams. It is time to do something. Saul waited. It had been hours since he had handed his only child to the shrike. It had been days since he had eaten or slept. Around him the storm had raged and abated. The tombs had glowed and rumbled like runaway reactors, and the time tides had whipped him with tsunami force. But Saul had clung to the stone steps of the Sphinx and waited through it all. He waited now. Half-conscious, pummeled by fatigue and fear for his daughter, Saul found that his scholar's mind was working at a rapid pace. For most of his life and for all of his career, Saul Weintraub, the historian come classicist come philosopher, had dealt with the ethics of human religious behavior. Religion and ethics were not always, or even frequently, mutually compatible. The demands of religious absolutism or fundamentalism or rampaging relativism often reflected the worst aspects of contemporary culture or prejudices, rather than a system which both man and God could live under with a sense of real justice. Saul's most famous book, finally titled Abraham's Dilemma when it was brought out in a mass-market edition in numbers he had never dreamed of while producing volumes for academic presses, had been written when Rachel was dying of Merlin's sickness and dealt, obviously enough, with Abraham's hard choice of obeying or disobeying God's direct command for him to sacrifice his son. Saul had written that primitive times had required primitive obedience, that later generations evolved to the point where parents offered themselves as sacrifice, as in the dark nights of the ovens which pocked old Earth history, and that current generations had to deny any command for sacrifice. Saul had written that whatever form God now took in human consciousness, whether as a mere manifestation of the subconscious in all its revanchist needs, or as a more conscious attempt at philosophical and ethical evolution, humankind could no longer agree to offer up sacrifice in God's name. Sacrifice and the agreement to sacrifice had written human history in blood. Yet hours ago, ages ago, Saul Weintraub had handed his only child to a creature of death. For years, the voice in his dreams had commanded him to do so. For years, Saul had refused. He had agreed, finally, only when time was gone, when any other hope was gone, and when he had realized that the voice in his and Sarai's dreams all those years had not been the voice of God, nor of some dark force allied with the Shrike. It had been the voice of their daughter. With a sudden clarity which went beyond the immediacy of his pain or sorrow, Saul Weintraub suddenly understood perfectly why Abraham had agreed to sacrifice Isaac, his son, when the Lord commanded him to do so. It was not obedience. It was not even to put the love of God above the love of his son. Abraham was testing God. By denying the sacrifice at the last moment, by stopping the knife, God had earned the right in Abraham's eyes and the hearts of his offspring to become the God of Abraham. Saul shuddered as he thought of how no posturing on Abraham's part, no shamming of his willingness to sacrifice the boy, could have served to forge that bond between greater power and humankind. Abraham had to know in his own heart that he would kill his son. The deity, whatever form it then took, had to know Abraham's determination, had to feel that sorrow and commitment to destroy what was to Abraham the most precious thing in the universe. Abraham came not to sacrifice, but to know once and for all whether this God was a God to be trusted and obeyed. No other test would do. Why then, thought Saul, clinging to the stone stair as the Sphinx seemed to rise and fall on the storm seas of time, why was this test being repeated? What terrible new revelations lay at hand for humankind? Saul understood then, from what little Braun had told him, from the stories shared on the pilgrimage, from his own personal revelations of the past few weeks, that the effort of the machine ultimate intelligence, whatever the hell it was, to flush out the missing empathy entity of the human Godhead was useless. Saul no longer saw the tree of thorns on its clifftop, its metal branches and suffering multitudes. But he did see clearly now that the thing was as much an organic machine as the Shrike, an instrument to broadcast suffering through the universe, so the human God part would be forced to respond, to show itself. If God evolved, and Saul was sure that God must, then that evolution was toward empathy, toward a shared sense of suffering rather than power and dominion. But the obscene tree which the pilgrims had glimpsed, which poor Martin Silenus had been a victim of, was not the way to evoke the missing power. Saul realized now that the machine God, whatever its form, was insightful enough to see that empathy was a response to others' pain. But the same UI was too stupid to realize that empathy, in both human terms and the terms of humankind's UI, was far more than that. Empathy and love were inseparable and inexplicable. The machine UI would never understand it, not even enough to use it as a lure for the part of the human UI which had tired of warfare and the distant future. Love, that most banal of things, that most cliched of religious motivations, had more power, Saul now knew, than did strong nuclear force or weak nuclear force or electromagnetism or gravity. Love was these other forces, Saul realized. The void which binds, the sub-quantum impossibility that carried information from photon to photon, was nothing more or less than love. But could love, simple, banal love, explain the so-called anthropic principle which scientists had shaken their collective heads over for seven centuries and more? That almost infinite string of coincidences which had led to a universe that had just the proper number of dimensions, just the correct values on electron, just the precise rules for gravity, just the proper age to stars, just the right pre-biologies to create just the perfect viruses to become just the proper DNAs. In short, a series of coincidences so absurd in their precision and correctness that they defied logic, defied understanding, and even defied religious interpretation. Love? For 7 centuries, the existence of grand unification theories and hyperstring post-quantum physics and core-given understanding of the universe as self-contained and boundless, without Big Bang singularities or corresponding endpoints, had pretty much eliminated any role of God, primitively anthropomorphic or sophisticatedly post-Einsteinian, even as a caretaker or pre-creation former of rules. The modern universe, as machine and man had come to understand it, needed no creator, in fact, allowed no creator. Its rules allowed very little tinkering and no major revisions. It had not begun and would not end, beyond cycles of expansion and contraction, as regular and self-regulated as the seasons on old Earth. No room for love there. It seemed that Abraham had offered to murder his son to test a phantom. It seemed that Saul had brought his dying daughter through hundreds of light-years and innumerable hardships in response to nothing. But now, as the Sphinx loomed above him, and the first hint of sunrise paled Hyperion's sky, Saul realized that he had responded to a force more basic and persuasive than the Shrike's terror or Pain's dominion. If he was right, and he did not know but felt, then love was as hardwired into the structure of the universe as gravity and matter-antimatter. There was room for some sort of God, not in the web between the walls, nor in the singularity cracks in the pavement, nor somewhere out before and beyond the sphere of things, but in the very warp and woof of things, evolving as the universe evolved, learning as the learning-able parts of the universe learned, loving as humankind loved. Saul got to his knees and then to his feet. The time-tide storm seemed to have abated a bit, and he thought he could try for the 100th time to gain access to the tomb. Bright light still emanated from where the Shrike had emerged, taken Saul's daughter and vanished. But now the stars were disappearing as the sky itself lightened toward morning. Saul climbed the stairs. He remembered the time at home on Barnard's World when Rachel, she was 10, had tried to climb the town's tallest elm and had fallen when she was 5 meters from the top. Saul had rushed to the med center to find his child floating in the recovery nutrient and suffering from a punctured lung, a broken leg and ribs, a fractured jaw, and innumerable cuts and bruises. She had smiled at him, lifted a thumb, and said through her wired jaw, "I'll make it next time." Saul and Sarai had sat there in the med center that night while Rachel slept. They had waited for morning. Saul had held her hand through the night. He waited now. Time tides from the open entrance to the Sphinx still held Saul back like insistent winds, but he leaned into them like an immovable rock and stood there, 5 meters out and waiting, squinting into the glare. He glanced up but did not move back when he saw the fusion flame of a descending spacecraft slice the pre-dawn sky. He turned to look but did not retreat when he heard the spacecraft landing and saw 3 figures emerge. He glanced but did not step back when he heard other noises, shouts, from deeper in the valley, and saw a familiar figure lugging another in a fireman's carry, moving toward him from beyond the jade tomb. None of these things related to his child. He waited for Rachel. Even without a datasphere, it is quite possible for my persona to travel through the rich, void which binds soup which now surrounds Hyperion. My immediate reaction is to want to visit the one who will be. But although that one's brilliance dominates the metasphere, I am not yet ready for that. I am, after all, little John Keats, not John the Baptist. The Sphinx, a tomb patterned after a real creature that will not be designed by genetic engineers for centuries to come, is a maelstrom of temporal energies. There are really several sphinxes visible to my expanded sight. The anti-entropic tomb carrying its shrike cargo back in time like some sealed container with its deadly bacillus. The active, unstable sphinx, which contaminated Rachel Weintraub in its initial effort to open a portal through time. And the sphinx which has opened and is moving forward through time again. This last sphinx is the blazing portal of light, which, second only to the one who will be, lights Hyperion with its metaspherical bonfire. I descend to this bright place in time to watch Saul Weintraub hand his daughter to the shrike. I could not have interfered with this even if I had arrived earlier. I would not if I were able. Worlds beyond reason depend upon this act. But I await within the Sphinx for the shrike to pass, carrying its tender cargo. Now I can see the child. She is seconds old, blotched, moist, and wrinkled. She is crying her newborn lungs out. From my old attitudes of bachelorhood and reflective poet stance, I find it hard to understand the attraction this bawling, unaesthetic infant exerts on its father and the cosmos. Still, the sight of a baby's flesh, however unattractive this newborn might be, held by the shrike's bladed talons, stirs something in me. 3 paces into the Sphinx have carried the shrike and the child hours forward in time. Just beyond the entrance, the river of time accelerates. If I don't do something within seconds, it will be too late. The shrike will have used this portal to carry the child off to whatever distant future dark hole it seeks. Unbidden, the images arrive of spiders draining their victims of fluids, of digger wasps burying their own larvae in the paralyzed bodies of their prey, perfect sources for incubation and food. I have to act, but I have no more solidity here than I had in the core. The shrike walks through me as if I were an unseen hollow. My analog persona is useless here, armless and insubstantial as a wisp of swamp gas. But swamp gas has no brain, and John Keats did. The shrike takes another 2 steps, and more hours pass for Saul and the others outside. I can see blood on the crying infant's skin where the shrike's scalpeled fingers have cut into flesh. To hell with this. Outside, on the broad stone porch of the Sphinx, caught now in the flood of temporal energies flowing in and through the tomb, lay backpacks, blankets, abandoned food containers, and all the detritus Saul and the pilgrims have left there, including a single Mobius cube. The box had been sealed with a Class 8 containment field on the Templar tree ship Yggdrasil when Voice of the Tree Hetmastine had prepared for his long voyage. It contained a single Urg, sometimes known as a binder, one of the small creatures which might not be intelligent by human standards, but which had evolved around distant stars and developed the ability to control more powerful force fields than any machine known to humankind. The Templars and Ousters had communicated with the creatures for generations. Templars used them for control redundancy on their beautiful but exposed tree ships. Hetmastine had brought this thing hundreds of light years to complete the Templar agreement with the Church of the Final Atonement to help fly the Shrike's thorn tree. But seeing the Shrike and the Tree of Torment, Mastine had not been able to fulfill the contract, and so he died. The Mobius cube remained. The Urg was visible to me as a constrained sphere of red energy in the temporal flood. Outside, through a curtain of darkness, Saul Weintraub was just visible, a sadly comic figure, speeded up like a silent film figure by the subjective rush of time beyond the Sphinx's temporal field. But the Mobius cube lay within the Sphinx's circle. Rachel cried with the fear even a newborn can know, fear of falling, fear of pain, fear of separation. The shrike took a step, and another hour was lost to those outside. I was insubstantial to the shrike, but energy fields are something which even we core analog ghosts can touch. I canceled the Mobius Cube's containment field. I freed the Urg. Templars communicate with Urgs via electromagnetic radiation, coded pulses, simple rewards of radiation when the creature does what they want, but primarily through a near-mystical form of contact which only the Brotherhood and a few ouster exotics know. Scientists call it a crude telepathy. In truth, it is almost pure empathy. The Shrike takes another step into the opening portal to the future. Rachel cries with the energy only someone newly born to the universe can muster. The Urg expands, understands, and melds with my persona. John Keats takes on substance and form. I hurry the 5 paces to the Shrike, remove the baby from its hands, and step back. Even in the energy maelstrom that is the Sphinx, I can smell the infant newness of her as I hold the child against my chest and cup her moist head against my cheek. The Shrike whirls in surprise, forearms extend, blades snick open, and red eyes focus on me. But the creature is too close to the portal itself. Without moving, it recedes down the storm drain of temporal flow. The thing's steam shovel jaws open, steel teeth gnash, but it is already gone, a spot in the distance, something less. I turn toward the entrance, but it is too far. The Urg's draining energy could get me there, drag me upstream against the flow, but not with Rachel. Carrying another living thing that far against so much force is more than I can manage, even with the Urg's help. The baby cries, and I bounce her gently, whispering nonsense doggerel in her warm ear. If we can't go back and we can't go forward, we'll just wait here for a moment. Perhaps someone will come along. Martin Silenus's eyes widened, and Braun Lamia turned quickly, seeing the Shrike floating in midair above and behind her. "Holy shit," Braun whispered reverently. In the Shrike Palace, tiers of sleeping human bodies receded in the gloom and distance. All of the people except Martin Silenus still connected to the Thorn Tree, the machine UI, and God knows what else by pulsing umbilicals. As if to show its power here, the Shrike had quit climbing, opened its arms, and floated up 3 meters until it hung in the air 5 meters out from the stone shelf where Braun crouched next to Martin Silenus.
"Do something," whispered Silenus.
The poet was no longer attached by the neural shunt umbilical, but he was still too weak to hold his head up.
"Ideas?" said Braun,
the brave remark somewhat ruined by the quaver in her voice.
"Trust," said a voice below them, and Braun shifted to look down toward the floor.
The young woman whom Braun had recognized as Moneta in Kassad's tomb stood far below.
"Help!" cried Braun.
"Trust," said Moneta, and disappeared.
The Shrike had not been distracted. It lowered its hands and stepped forward, as if walking on solid stone rather than air.
"Shit," whispered Braun.
"Ditto,"
rasped Martin Silenus.
"Out of the frying pan, back into the fucking fire!"
"Shut up,"
said Braun. Then, as if to herself,
"Trust what? Who?"
"Trust the fucking Shrike to kill us or stick us both on the fucking tree," gasped Silenus.
He managed to move enough to clutch Braun's arm.
"Better dead than back on the tree, Braun!"
Braun touched his hand briefly and stood, facing the Shrike across 5 meters of air.
"Trust?"
Braun held her foot out, felt around on emptiness, closed her eyes for a second, and opened them as her foot seemed to touch a solid step. She opened her eyes. Nothing was under her foot except air.
"Trust?"
Braun put her weight on her forward foot and stepped out, teetering a moment before bringing her other foot down.
She and the shrike stood facing each other, 10 meters above the stone floor. The creature seemed to grin at her as it opened its arms. Its carapace glowed dully in the dim light. Its red eyes were very bright. Trust? Feeling the adrenaline rush, Braun stepped forward on the invisible steps, gaining height as she moved into the shrike's embrace. She felt the finger blades slicing through fabric and skin as the thing began to hug her to it, toward the curved blade growing out of its metal chest, toward the open jaws and rows of steel teeth. But while still standing firmly on thin air, Braun leaned forward and set her uninjured hand flat against the shrike's chest. Feeling the coldness of the carapace, but also feeling a rush of warmth as energy rushed from her, out of her, through her. The blades stopped cutting before they cut anything but skin. The shrike froze as if the flow of temporal energy surrounding them had turned to a lump of amber. Braun set her hand on the thing's broad chest and pushed. The shrike froze completely in place, became brittle, the gleam of metal fading to be replaced by the transparent glow of crystal, the bright sheen of glass. Braun stood on air, being embraced by a 3-meter glass sculpture of the shrike. In its chest, where a heart might be, something that looked like a large black moth fluttered and beat sooty wings against the glass. Braun took a deep breath and pushed again. The shrike slid backward on the invisible platform she shared with it, teetered, and fell. Braun ducked under the encircling arms, hearing and feeling her jacket tearing as the still-sharp finger blades caught in the material and ripped as the thing tumbled. And then she was teetering herself, flailing her good arm for balance, as the glass shrike turned 1.5 times in midair, struck the floor, and shattered into 1,000 jagged shards. Braun pivoted, fell to her knees on the invisible catwalk, and crawled back toward Martin Silenus. In the last half meter, her confidence failed her. The invisible support simply ceased to be, and she fell heavily, twisting her ankle as she hit the edge of the stone tier and managing to keep from falling off only by grabbing Silenus's knee. Cursing from the pain in her shoulder, broken wrist, twisted ankle, and lacerated palms and knees, she pulled herself to safety next to him.
"There's obviously been some weird shit going on since I left," Martin Silenus said hoarsely. "Can we go now? Or do you plan to walk on water as an encore?"
"Shut up," Braun said shakily. The two syllables sounded almost affectionate. She rested a while and then found that the easiest way to get the still-weak poet down the steps and across the glass-strewn floor of the Shrike Palace was to use the fireman's carry. They were at the entrance when he pounded unceremoniously on her back and said,
"What about King Billy and the others?"
"Later," panted Braun and stepped out into the pre-dawn light. She had hobbled down 2/3 of the valley with Silenus draped over her shoulders like so much limp laundry when the poet said,
"Braun, are you still pregnant?"
"Yes," she said, praying that that was still true after the day's exertions.
"You want me to carry you?"
"Shut up," she said, and followed the path down and around the jade tomb.
"Look,"
said Martin Silenus, twisting to point even as he hung almost upside down over her shoulder. In the glowing light of morning, Braun could see that the consul's ebony spacecraft now sat on the high ground at the entrance to the valley. But that was not what the poet was pointing toward. Saul Weintraub stood silhouetted in the glare of the Sphinx's entrance. His arms were raised. Someone or something was emerging from the glare. Saul saw her first. A figure walking amidst the torrent of light and liquid time flowing from the Sphinx. A woman, he saw, as she was silhouetted against the brilliant portal. A woman carrying something. A woman carrying an infant. His daughter Rachel emerged. Rachel, as he had last seen her as a healthy young adult, leaving to do her doctoral work on some world called Hyperion. Rachel, in her mid-twenties. Perhaps even a bit older now, but Rachel. No doubt about that. Rachel, with her copperish brown hair still short and falling across her forehead, her cheeks flushed as they always were, as with some new enthusiasm. Her smile soft, almost tremulous now, and her eyes, those enormous green eyes with specks of brown just visible. Those eyes fixed on Saul. Rachel was carrying Rachel. The infant squirmed with its face against the young woman's shoulder, tiny hands clenching and unclenching as it tried to decide whether to start crying again or not. Saul stood stunned. He tried to speak, failed, and tried again. "Rachel." "Father," said the young woman, and stepped forward, putting her free arm around the scholar, while she turned slightly to keep the baby from being crushed between them. Saul kissed his grown daughter, hugged her, smelled the clean scent of her hair, felt the firm reality of her, and then lifted the infant to his own neck and shoulder, feeling the shudders pass through the newborn as she took a breath before crying. The Rachel he had brought to Hyperion was safe in his hands, small, red face wrinkled as she tried to focus her randomly wandering eyes on her father's face. Saul cupped her tiny head in his palm and lifted her closer, inspecting that small face for a second, before turning toward the young woman.
"Is she?"
"She's aging normally," said his daughter. She was wearing something, part gown, part robe, made of soft brown material. Saul shook his head, looked at her, saw her smiling, and noticed the same small dimple below and to the left of her mouth that was visible on the infant he held. He shook his head again.
How is this possible?"
"It's not for very long," said Rachel. Saul leaned forward and kissed his grown daughter's cheek again. He realized that he was crying, but he would not release either hand to wipe away the tears. His grown Rachel did so for him, touching his cheek gently with the back of her hand. There was a noise below them on the steps, and Saul looked over his shoulder to see the three men from the ship standing there, red-faced from running, and Braun Lamia helping the poet Silenus to a seat on the white slab of railing stone. The consul and Theo Lane looked up at them.
"Rachel," whispered Melio Arendez, his eyes filling.
"Rachel," said Martin Silenus, frowning and glancing at Braun Lamia.
Braun was staring with her mouth half open.
"Moneta,"
she said, pointing, then lowering her hand as she realized she was pointing.
"You're Moneta. Kassad's Moneta."
Rachel nodded, her smile gone.
"I have only a minute or two here," she said, "and much to tell you."
"No," said Saul, taking his grown daughter's hand. "You have to stay. I want you to stay with me."
Rachel smiled again.
"I will stay with you, Dad," she said softly, raising her other hand to touch the baby's head. "But only one of us can, and she needs you more."
She turned to the group below.
"Listen, please, all of you."
As the sun rose and touched the broken buildings of the poet's city, the consul's ship, the western cliffs, and the taller time tombs with its light, Rachel told her brief and tantalizing story of being chosen to be raised in a future where the final war raged between the core-spawned UI and the human spirit. It was, she said, a future of terrifying and wonderful mysteries, where humankind had spread across this galaxy and had begun to travel elsewhere.
"Other galaxies?" asked Theo Lane.
"Other universes,"
smiled Rachel.
Colonel Cassad knew you as Minetta, said Martin Silenus.
Will know me as Minetta, she said, her eyes clouding. I have seen him die and accompanied his tomb to the past. I know that part of my mission is to meet this fabled warrior and lead him forward to the final battle. I have not truly met him yet.
She looked down the valley toward the crystal monolith.
Moneta, she mused. It means admonisher in Latin. Appropriate. I will let him choose between that and mnemosyne, memory, for my name.
Saul had not released his daughter's hand. He did not do so now.
You're traveling back in time with the tombs?
Why? How?
Rachel lifted her head, and reflected light from the far cliffs painted her face in warmth. It is my role, Dad. My duty. They give me means to keep the Shrike in check, and only I was prepared.
Saul lifted his infant daughter higher. Startled from sleep, she blew a single bubble of saliva, turned her face into her father's neck for warmth, and curled her small fists against his shirt.
Prepared, said Saul. You mean the Merlin sickness?
Yes, said Rachel.
Saul shook his head.
But you weren't raised in some mysterious world of the future. You grew up in the college town of Crawford, on Furtick Street, on Barnard's World, and you're...
He stopped. Rachel nodded. She shall grow up. Up there. Dad, I'm sorry, I have to go.
She freed her hand, drifted down the stairs, and touched Melio Arandez's cheek briefly.
I'm sorry for the pain of memory, she said softly to the startled archaeologist. To me it was, literally, a different life. Arandez blinked and held her hand to his cheek a moment longer. Are you married? Asked Rachel softly. Children? Arandez nodded, moved his other hand as if he were going to remove the pictures of his wife and grown children from his pocket, and then stopped, nodded again. Rachel smiled, kissed him quickly on the cheek again, and moved back up the steps. The sky was rich with sunrise, but the door to the Sphinx was still brighter. Dad, she said, I love you.
Saul tried to speak, cleared his throat.
How do I join you up there?
Rachel gestured toward the open door of the Sphinx.
For some it will be a portal to the time I spoke of. But, Dad, she hesitated, it will mean raising me all over again. It means suffering through my childhood for a third time. No parent should be asked to do that.
Saul managed a smile.
No parent would refuse that, Rachel.
He changed arms holding the sleeping infant and shook his head again.
Will there be a time when the two of you
coexist again? Smiled Rachel. No, I go the other way now. You can't imagine the difficulty I had with the Paradox Board to get this one meeting approved.
Paradox Board? Said Saul.
Rachel took a breath. She had stepped back until only her fingertips touched her father's, both their arms extended.
I have to go, Dad.
Will I?
He looked at the baby.
Will we be alone? Up there?
Rachel laughed, and the sound was so familiar that it closed around Saul's heart like a warm hand.
Oh, no, she said, not alone. There are wonderful people there. Wonderful things to learn and do. Wonderful places to see.
She glanced around.
Places we have not imagined yet in our wildest dreams. No, Dad, you won't be alone. And I'll be there in all my teenage awkwardness and young adult cockiness.
She stepped back
and her fingers slipped away from Saul. "Wait a while before stepping through, Dad," she called, moving back into the brilliance. "It doesn't hurt. But once through, you can't come back."
"Rachel, wait," said Saul.
His daughter stepped back, her long robe flowing across stone, until the light surrounded her. She raised one arm. "See you later, alligator," she called. Saul raised a hand. "After a while, crocodile." The older Rachel was gone in the light. The baby awoke and began to cry. It was more than an hour before Saul and the others returned to the Sphinx. They had gone to the consul's ship to tend to Braun's and Martin Silenus's injuries, to eat, and to outfit Saul and the child for a voyage.
"I feel silly packing for what may be like a step through a Farcaster," said Saul. "But no wonder how wonderful this future is. If it doesn't have nursing packs and disposable diapers, we're in trouble."
The consul grinned and patted the full backpack on the step.
"This should get you and the baby through the first 2 weeks. If you don't find a diaper service by then, go to one of those other universes Rachel spoke about."
Saul shook his head. "Is this happening?"
"Wait a few days or weeks," said Emilio Arendez. "Stay here with us until things get sorted out. There's no hurry. The future will always be there."
Saul scratched his beard as he fed the baby with one of the nursing packs the ship had manufactured.
"We're not sure this portal will always be open," he said. "Besides, I might lose my nerve. I'm getting pretty old to raise a child again, especially as a stranger in a strange land."
Arendez set his strong hand on Saul's shoulder.
"Let me go with you. I'm dying of curiosity about this place."
Saul grinned and extended his hand, shook Arendez's firmly. "Thank you, my friend. But you have a wife and children back in the web, on Renaissance Vector, who await your return. You have your own duties."
Arendez nodded and looked at the sky. "If we can return."
"We'll return," the consul said flatly. "Old-fashioned Hawking drive spaceflight still works, even if the web is gone forever. It'll be a few years' time, Detmelio, but you'll get back."
Saul nodded, finished feeding the baby, set a clean cloth diaper on his shoulder, and patted her firmly on the back. He looked around the small circle of people.
"We all have our duties."
He shook hands with Martin Silenus. The poet had refused to crawl into the nutrient recovery bath, or have the neural shunt socket surgically removed.
"I've had these things before," he'd said.
"Will you continue your poem?"
Saul asked him.
Silenus shook his head. "I finished it on the tree," he said. "And I discovered something else there, Saul."
The scholar raised an eyebrow.
"I learned that poets aren't God. But if there is a God, or anything approaching a God, he's a poet, and a failed one at that."
The baby burped. Martin Silenus grinned and shook Saul's hand a final time.
"Give them hell up there, Weintraub. Tell him you're their great-great-great-great-great-granddaddy, and if they misbehave, you'll whoop their butts."
Saul nodded and moved down the line to Braun Lamia.
"I saw you conferring with the ship's medical terminal," he said. "Is everything all right with you and your unborn child?"
Braun grinned. "Everything's fine."
"A boy or a girl?"
"Girl." Saul kissed her on the cheek. Braun touched his beard and turned her face away to hide tears unbecoming a former private investigator.
"Girls are such a chore," he said,
disentangling Rachel's fingers from his beard and Braun's curls.
"Trade yours in for a boy the first chance you get."
"Okay," said Braun and stepped back. He shook hands a final time with the consul, Theo, and Emilio, shouldered his pack while Braun held the infant, and then took Rachel in his arms.
"Hell of an anticlimax if this thing doesn't work, and I end up wandering around inside of the Sphinx," he said.
The consul squinted at the glowing door. It will work. Although how, I'm not sure. I don't think it's a forecaster of any sort.
A Wencaster,
ventured Silenus, and held up his arm to block Braun's blows. The poet took a step back and shrugged.
If it continues to work, Saul, I have a feeling you won't be alone up there. Thousands will join you.
If the paradox board permits, said Saul, tugging at his beard the way he always did when his mind was elsewhere. He blinked, shifted backpack and baby, and stepped forward. The fields of force from the open door let him advance this time. So long, everyone, he cried. By God, it was all worth it, wasn't it? He turned into the light, and he and the baby were gone. There was a silence bordering on emptiness, which stretched for several minutes. Finally, the consul said, in almost embarrassed tones,
Shall we go up to the ship?
Bring the elevator down for the rest of us, said Martin Silenus. M. Lamia here will walk on air.
Braun glared at the diminutive poet.
You think it was something Moneta arranged? Said Arendez, referring to something Braun had suggested earlier.
It had to be, said Braun. Some bit of future science or something.
Ah, yes, sighed Martin Silenus. Future science. That familiar phrase from those too timid to be superstitious. The alternative, my dear, is that you have this hitherto untapped power to levitate and turn monsters into shatterable glass goblins.
Shut up, said Braun, with no undertones of affection in her voice now. She looked over her shoulder.
Who says another shrike won't show up any minute?
Who indeed, agreed the consul.
I suspect we'll always have a shrike or rumors of a shrike.
Theo Lane, always embarrassed by discord, cleared his throat and said,
Look what I found among the baggage strewn around the Sphinx.
He held up an instrument with three strings, a long neck, and bright designs painted on its triangular body.
A guitar?
A balalaika, said Braun. It belonged to Father Hoyt. The consul took the instrument and strummed several chords.
Do you know this song?
He played a few notes.
The lead a tit screwing song?
Ventured Martin Silenus. The consul shook his head and played several more chords.
Something old? Guessed Braun.
Somewhere over the rainbow, said Melio Arendez.
That must be before my time, said Theo Lane,
nodding along as the consul strummed.
It's from everybody's time, said the consul. Come on, I'll teach you the words as we go.
Walking together in the hot sun, singing off-key and on, losing the words and then starting again, they went uphill to the waiting ship.